Suddenly she laughed and held out her arms. "I'm arguing when there's no need for words. Come to me, my love. Wherever you are, come to me." He touched her and then put his arms around her. He found her mouth and devoured her. But he was forced to release her. "What is it, Gully darling?"
"I'm not a child any more," he said wearily. "I've learned to understand that nothing is simple. There's never a simple answer. You can love someone and loathe them."
"Can you, Gully?"
"And you're making me loathe myself."
"No, my dear."
"I've been a tiger all my life. I trained myself, educated myself, pulled myself up by my stripes to make me a stronger tiger with a longer claw and a sharper tooth, quick and deadly."
"And you are, the deadliest."
"No, I'm not. I went too far. I went beyond simplicity. I turned myself into a thinking creature. I look through your blind eyes, my love whom I loathe, and I see myself. The tiger's gone."
"There's no place for the tiger to go. You're trapped, Gully, by Dagenham, intelligence, my father, the world."
"I know."
"But you're safe with me. We're safe together, the pair of us. They'll never dream of looking for you near me. We can plan together, fight together, destroy them together."
"No, not together."
"What is it?" she flared again. "Are you still hunting me? Is that what's wrong? Do you still want revenge? Then take it. Here I am. Go ahead, destroy me."
"No. Destruction's finished for me."
"Ah, I know what it is." She became tender again in an instant. "It's your face, poor darling. You're ashamed of your tiger face. But I love it. You burn so brightly for me. You burn through the blindness. Believe me."
"My God, what a pair of loathsome freaks we are."
"What's happened to you?" she demanded.
She broke away from him, her coral eyes glittering.
"Where's the man who watched the raid with me? Where's the unashamed savage who..."
"Gone, Olivia. You've lost him. We both have."
"Gully!"
"He's lost."
"But why? What have I done?"
"You don't understand, Olivia."
"Where are you?"
She reached out, touched him, and then clung to him.
"Listen to me, darling. You're tired. You're exhausted. That's all. Nothing is lost."
The words tumbled out of her.
"You're right. Of course you're right. We've been bad, both of us. Loathsome. But all that's gone now. Nothing is lost. We were wicked because we were alone and unhappy. But we found each other. We can save each other. Be my love, darling. Always. Forever. I've looked for you so long, waited and hoped and prayed."
"No. You're lying, Olivia, and you know it."
"For God's sake, Gully."
"Put Vorga down, Olivia."
"Land?"
"Yes."
"On Terra?"
"Yes."
"What are you going to do? You're insane. They're hunting you, waiting for you, watching. What are you going to do?"
"Do you think this is easy for me?" he said. "I'm doing what I have to do. I'm still driven. No man ever escapes from that. But there's a different compulsion in the saddle, and the spurs hurt, damn it. They hurt like hell."
He stifled his anger and controlled himself. He took her hands and kissed her palms.
"It's all finished, Olivia," he said gently. "But I love you. Always. Forever."
"I'll sum it up," Dagenham rapped. "We were bombed the night we found Foyle. We lost him on the moon and found him a week later on Mars. We were bombed again. We lost him again. He's been lost for a week. Another bombing's due. Which one of the inner planets? Venus? The moon? Terra again? Who knows? But we all know this. One more raid without retaliation and we're lost."
He glanced around the table. Against the ivory and gold background of the star chamber of Castle Prestane, his face, all three faces, looked strained. Yang Yeovil slitted his eyes in a frown. Prestane compressed his thin lips.
"And we know this, too," Dagenham continued. "We can't retaliate without pyre, and we can't locate the pyre without foil." "My instructions were," Prestane interposed, "that pyre was not to be mentioned in public." "In the first place, this is not public," Dagenham snapped. "It's a private information pool. In the second place, we've gone beyond property rights. We're discussing survival, and we've all got equal rights in that."
"Yes, Jiz." Gisbella McQueen had jaunted into the Star Chamber, looking intent and furious. "Still no sign of foil."
"Old St. Pat still being watched?"
"Yes."
"Commando Brigade's report in from Mars yet?"
"No." "That's my business, and most secret," Yang Yeovil objected mildly.
"You've got as few secrets from me as I have from you."
Dagenham grinned mirthlessly.
"See if you can beat Central Intelligence back here with that report, Chiz. Go."
She disappeared. "About property rights," Yang Yeovil murmured. "May I suggest to Prestane that Central Intelligence will guarantee full payment to him for his right, title, and interest in Pyre?"
"Don't coddle him, Yeovil." "This conference is being recorded," Prestane said coldly. "The captain's offer is now on file."
He turned his basilisk face to Dagenham.
"You are in my employ, Mr. Dagenham. Please control your references to myself." "And to your property?" Dagenham inquired with a deadly smile. "You and your damn property. All of you and all of your damn property have put us in this hole. The system's on the edge of total annihilation for the sake of your property. I'm not exaggerating. It will be a shooting war to end all wars if we can't stop it."
"We can always surrender," Prestane answered.
"No," Yang Yeovil said. "That's already been discussed and discarded at HQ. We know the post-victory plans of the outer satellites. They involve total exploitation of the inner planets. We're to be gutted and worked until nothing's left. Surrender would be as disastrous as defeat."
"But not for Prestane," Dagenham added.
"Shall we say, present company excluded?" Yang Yeovil replied gracefully.
"All right, Prestane." Dagenham swiveled in his chair. "Give." "I beg your pardon, sir. Let's hear all about Pyre. I've got an idea how we can bring foil out into the open and locate the stuff, but I've got to know all about it first. Make your contribution."
"No,"
Prestane answered.
"No what?" "I have decided to withdraw from this information pool. I will reveal nothing about Pyre." "For God's sake, Prestane, are you insane? What's got into you? Are you fighting Regis Sheffield's Liberal Party again?"
"It's quite simple, Dagenham," Yang Yeovil interposed. "My information about the surrender-defeat situation has shown Prestane a way to better his position. No doubt he intends negotiating a sale to the enemy in return for property advantages."
"Can nothing move you?" Dagenham asked Prestane scornfully. "Can nothing touch you? Are you all property and nothing else? Go away, Jiz. The whole thing's fallen apart."
Gisbella had jaunted into the Star Chamber again. "Commando Brigade's reported," she said. "We know what happened to Foyle."
"What?"
"Prestane's got him."
"What?"
Both Dagenham and Yang Yeovil started to their feet. "He left Mars in a private yawl, was shut up, and was observed being picked up by the Prestane SS Vorga."
"Damn you, Prestane!" Dagenham snapped. "So that's why you've been..."
"Wait," Yang Yeovil commanded. "It's news to him too, Dagenham. Look at him." Prestane's handsome face had gone the colour of ashes. He tried to rise and fell back stiffly in his chair.
"Olivia," he whispered. "With him? That scum..."
"Prestane?"
"My daughter, gentlemen, has for some time been engaged in certain activities. The family vice. Blood and... have managed to close my eyes to it, had almost convinced myself that I was mistaken. But foil, dirt, filth, he must be destroyed!
Prestaine's voice soared alarmingly. His head twisted back like a hangman's, and his body began to shudder.
What in the...
Epilepsy, Yang Yeovil said. He pulled Prestaine out of the chair onto the floor. A spoon, Miss McQueen, quick!
He levered Prestaine's teeth open and placed a spoon between them to protect the tongue.
As suddenly as it had began, the seizure was over. The shuddering stopped. Prestaine opened his eyes.
Petit mal, Yang Yeovil murmured, withdrawing the spoon. But he'll be dazed for a while.
Suddenly Prestaine began speaking in a low monotone.
Pyre is a pyrophoric alloy. A pyrophore is a metal which emits sparks when scraped or struck. Pyre admits energy, which is why E, the energy symbol, was added to the prefix pyre. Pyre is a solid solution of transplutonium isotopes, releasing thermonuclear energy on the order of stellar phoenix action. Its discoverer was of the opinion that he had produced the equivalent of the primordial protomatter which exploded into the universe.
My God!
Gisbella exclaimed. Dagenham silenced her with a gesture and bent over Prestaine.
How is it brought to critical mass, Prestaine? How is the energy released?
As the original energy was generated in the beginning of time, Prestaine droned, through will and idea.
I'm convinced he's a cellar Christian,
Dagenham muttered to Yang Yeovil. He raised his voice.
Will you explain, Prestaine?
Through will and ideas, Prestaine repeated. Pyre can only be exploded by psychokinesis. Its energy can only be released by thought. It must be willed to explode, and the thought directed at it. That is the only way.
There's no key, no formula,
no. Only will and idea are necessary.
The glazed eyes closed.
God in heaven!
Dagenham mopped his brow.
Will this give the art of satellites pause, Yeovil?
It'll give us all pause. It's the road to hell, Gisbella said.
Then let's find it and get off the road. Here's my idea, Yeovil. Foyle was tinkering with that hell brew in his lab in Old St. Pat's, trying to analyze it.
I told you that in strict confidence,
Gisbella said furiously.
I'm sorry, dear. We're past honor in the decencies. Now look, Yeovil, there must be some fragments of the stuff lying about, as dust, in solution, in precipitates. We've got to detonate those fragments and blow the hell out of Foyle Circus.
Why?
To bring him running. He must have the bulk of the pyre hidden there somewhere. He'll come to salvage it.
What if it blows up too?
It can't. Not inside an inert lead isotope safe.
Maybe it's not all inside.
Jiz says it is. At least so Foyle reported.
Leave me out of this,
Gisbella said.
Anyway, we'll have to gamble.
Gamble?
Yang Yeovil exclaimed. On a phoenix action. You'll gamble the solar system into a brand new nova.
What else can we do? Pick any other road, and it's the road to destruction, too. Have we got any choice?
We can wait,
Gisbella said.
For what? For Foyle to blow us up himself with his tinkering?
We can warn him.
We don't know where he is.
We can find him.
How soon? Won't that be a gamble too?
And what about that stuff lying around waiting for someone to think it into energy? Supposing a jackjaunter gets in and cracks the safe looking for goodies. And then we don't just have dust waiting for an accidental thought, but 20 pounds.
Gisbella turned pale. Dagenham turned to the intelligence man.
You make the decision, Yeovil. Do we try it my way or do we wait?
Yang Yeovil sighed.
I was afraid of this, he said.
Damn all scientists.
I'll have to make my decision for a reason you don't know, Dagenham. The outer satellites are onto this too. We've got reason to believe that they've got agents looking for Foyle in the worst way. If we wait, they may pick him up before us. In fact, they may have him now.
So your decision is?
The blow-up. Let's bring Foyle running if we can.
No!
Gisbella cried.
How?
Dagenham asked, ignoring her.
"Oh, I've got just the one for the job. A one-way telepath named Robin Wednesbury."
"When?"
"At once. We'll clear the entire neighbourhood. We'll get full news coverage and do a full broadcast. If Foyle's anywhere in the inner planets, he'll hear about it." "Not about it," Gisbella said in despair. "He'll hear it. It'll be the last thing any of us hear."
"Will and idea," Prestain whispered.
As always, when he returned from a stormy civil court session in Leningrad, Regis Sheffield was pleased and complacent, rather like a cocky prize-fighter who's won a tough fight. He stopped off at Bleckmann's in Berlin for a drink and some war talk, had a second and more war talk in a legal hangout on the Quai d'Orsay, and a third session in the Skin and Bones opposite Temple Bar. By the time he arrived in his New York office, he was pleasantly illuminated. As he strode through the clattering corridors and outer rooms, he was greeted by his secretary with a handful of memo beads.
"Knock Jargor Danchenko for a loop," Sheffield reported triumphantly. "Judgment and full damages. Old Dee's sore as a boil. This makes the score 11-5, my favour."
He took the beads, juggled them, and then began tossing them into unlikely receptacles all over the office, including the open mouth of a gaping clerk.
"Really, Mr. Sheffield, have you been drinking?"
"No more work today. The war news is too damn gloomy. Have to do something to stay cheerful. What say we brawl in the streets?"
"Mr. Sheffield."
"Anything waiting for me that can't wait another day?"
"There's a gentleman in your office."
"He made you let him get that far?"
Sheffield looked impressed.
"Who is he, God or somebody?"
"He won't give his name. He gave me this."
The secretary handed Sheffield a sealed envelope. On it was scrawled, "Urgent." Sheffield tore it open, his blunt features crinkling with curiosity. Then his eyes widened. Inside the envelope were 2 50,000-krone notes. Sheffield turned without a word and burst into his private office. Foyle arose from his chair.
"These are genuine," Sheffield blurted, "to the best of my knowledge. Exactly 20 of these notes were minted last year. All are on deposit in Terran treasuries. How did you get hold of these two?" "Mr. Sheffield? Who else? How did you get hold of these notes?"
"Bribery."
"Why?" "I thought at the time that it might be convenient to have them available."
"For what? More bribery?"
"If legal fees are bribery."
"I set my own fees,"
Sheffield said. He tossed the notes back to Foyle.
"You can produce them again if I decide to take your case, and if I decide I've been worth that to you."
"What's your problem?"
"Criminal."
"Don't be too specific yet."
"And?"
"I want to give myself up."
"To the police?"
"Yes."
"For what crime?"
"Crimes."
"Name two."
"Robbery and rape."
"Name two more."
"Blackmail and murder."
"Any other items?"
"Treason and genocide."
"Does that exhaust your catalogue?"
"I think so.
We may be able to unveil a few more when we get specific."
"Been busy, haven't you? Either you're the prince of villains or insane."
"I've been both, Mr. Sheffield."
"Why do you want to give yourself up?"
"I've come to my senses,"
Foyle answered bitterly.
"I don't mean that. A criminal never surrenders while he's ahead. You're obviously ahead. What's the reason?"
"The most damnable thing that ever happened to a man. I picked up a rare disease called conscience."
Sheffield snorted.
"That can often turn fatal."
"It is fatal. I've realized that. I've been behaving like an animal."
"And now you want to purge yourself?"
"No, it isn't that simple,"
Foyle said grimly.
"That's why I've come to you. For major surgery.
The man who upsets the morphology of society is a cancer. The man who gives his own decisions priority over society is a criminal. But there are chain reactions. Purging yourself with punishment isn't enough. Everything's got to be set right. I wish to God everything could be cured just by sending me back to Gouffre Martel or shooting me.
back? Sheffield cut in keenly. Shall I be specific? Not yet. Go on. You sound as though you've got ethical growing pains.
That's it, exactly.
Foyle paced in agitation, crumpling the banknotes with nervous fingers.
This is one hell of a mess, Sheffield. There's a girl that's got to pay for a vicious, rotten crime. The fact that I love her... No, never mind that. She has a cancer that's got to be cut out. Like me. Which means I have to add informing to my catalogue. The fact that I'm giving myself up, too, doesn't make any difference.
What is all this mishmash?
Foyle turned on Sheffield.
One of the New Year's bombs has just walked into your office, and it's saying, put it all right, put me together again and send me home. Put together the city I flattened and the people I shattered. That's what I want to hire you for. I don't know how most criminals feel, but sensible, matter of fact, like good businessmen who've had bad luck.
Sheffield answered promptly.
That's the usual attitude of the professional criminal. It's obvious you're an amateur, if you're a criminal at all.
My dear sir, do be sensible. You come here extravagantly accusing yourself of robbery, rape, murder, genocide, treason, and God knows what else. You expect me to take you seriously?
Bunny, Sheffield's assistant, jaunted into the private office.
Chief, he shouted in excitement, something brand new's turned up. A lech jaunt. Two society kids bribed a C-class tart to... Oops, sorry. Didn't realize you had...
Bunny broke off and stared.
4 Mile,
he exclaimed.
What? Who?
Sheffield demanded.
Don't you know him, Chief?
Bunny stammered.
That's 4 Mile of Sirius. Gully Foyle.
More than a year ago, Regis Sheffield had been hypnotically fulminated and triggered for this moment. His body had been prepared to respond without thought, and the response was lightning. Sheffield struck Foyle in half a second, temple, throat, and groin. It had been decided not to depend on weapons, since none might be available. Foyle fell. Sheffield turned on Bunny and battered him back across the office. Then he spat into his palm. It had been decided not to depend on drugs, since drugs might not be available. Sheffield's salivary glands had been prepared to respond with anaphylaxis secretion to the stimulus. He ripped open Foyle's sleeve, dug a nail deep into the hollow of Foyle's elbow, and slashed. He pressed his spittle into the ragged cut and pinched the skin together. A strange cry was torn from Foyle's lips. The tattooing showed livid on his face. Before the stunned law assistant could make a move, Sheffield swung Foyle up to his shoulder and jaunted. He arrived in the middle of the 4 Mile circus in Old St. Pat's. It was a daring but calculated move. This was the last place he would be expected to go, and the first place where he might expect to locate the pyre. He was prepared to deal with anyone he might meet in the cathedral, but the interior of the circus was empty. The vacant tents ballooning up in the nave looked tattered. They had already been looted. Sheffield plunged into the first he saw. It was 4 Mile's travelling library, filled with hundreds of books and thousands of glittering novel beads. The jack hunters were not interested in literature. Sheffield threw Foyle down on the floor. Only then did he take a gun from his pocket. Foyle's eyelids fluttered. His eyes opened.
You're drugged, Sheffield said rapidly. Don't try to jaunt, and don't move. I'm warning you, I'm prepared for anything.
Dazedly, Foyle tried to rise. Sheffield instantly fired and seared his shoulder. Foyle was slammed back against the stone flooring. He was numbed and bewildered. There was a roaring in his ears and poison coursing through his blood.
I'm warning you, Sheffield repeated. I'm prepared for anything.
What do you want?
Foyle whispered.
2 things. 20 pounds of pyre and you. You most of all.
You lunatic. You damned maniac. I came to your office to give it up. Hand it over.
To the O.S.?
To the... what?
The outer satellites. Shall I spell it out for you?
No, Foyle muttered. I might have known. The Patriot Sheffield, an O.S. agent. I should have known. I'm a fool.
You're the most valuable fool in the world, Foyle. We want you even more than the pyre. That's an unknown to us, but we know what you are.
What are you talking about?
My God, you don't know, do you? You still don't know. You haven't an inkling.
Of what?
Listen to me, Sheffield said in a pounding voice. I'm taking you back 2 years to Nomad, understand? Back to the death of the Nomad. One of our raiders finished her off and they found you aboard the wreck, the last man alive.
So an OS ship did blast Nomad?
Yes. You don't remember?
I don't remember anything about that. I never could.
I'm telling you why. The raider got a clever idea. They'd turn you into a decoy, a sitting duck, understand? You were half dead, but they took you aboard and patched you up. They put you into a spacesuit and cast you adrift with your microwave on. You were broadcasting distress signals and mumbling for help on every wave band. The idea was they'd lurk nearby and pick off the IP ships that came to rescue you.
Foyle began to laugh.
I'm getting up, he said recklessly. Shoot again, you son of a bitch, but I'm getting up.
He struggled to his feet, clutching his shoulder.
So Vorga shouldn't have picked me up anyway, Foyle laughed. I was a decoy. Nobody should have come near me. I was a shill, a lure, death bait. Isn't that the final irony? Nomad didn't have any right to be rescued in the first place. I didn't have any right to revenge.
You still don't understand, Sheffield pounded. They were nowhere near Nomad when they set you adrift. They were 600,000 miles from Nomad.
600,000?
Nomad was too far out of the shipping lanes. They wanted you to drift where ships would pass. They took you 600,000 miles sunward and set you adrift. They put you through the airlock and backed off, watching you drift. Your suit lights were blinking and you were moaning for help on the microwave. Then you disappeared.
Disappeared?
You were gone. No more light, no more broadcast. They came back to check. You were gone without a trace. And the next thing we learned, you got back aboard Nomad.
Impossible.
Man, you're space jaunted,
Sheffield said savagely.
You were patched and delirious, but you're space jaunted. You're space jaunted 600,000 miles through the void, back to the wreck of the Nomad. You did something that's never been done before. God knows how. You don't even know yourself, but we're going to find out. I'm taking you out to the satellites with me, and we'll get that secret out of you if we have to tear it out.
He took Foyle's throat in his powerful hand and hefted the gun in the other.
But first I want the pyre. You'll produce it, Foyle. Don't think you won't.
He lashed Foyle across the forehead with the gun.
I'll do anything to get it. Don't think I won't.
He smashed Foyle again, coldly, efficiently.
If you're looking for a purge, man, you've found it.
Bunny leaped off the public jaunt stage at Five Points and streaked into the main entrance of Central Intelligence's New York office like a frightened rabbit. He shot past the outermost guard cordon, through the protective labyrinth, and into the inner offices. He acquired a train of excited pursuers and found himself face to face with the more seasoned guards, who had calmly jaunted to positions ahead of him and were waiting. Bunny began to shout,
Yovil! Yovil! Yovil!
Still running, he dodged around desks, kicked over chairs, and created an incredible uproar. He continued his yelling,
Yovil! Yovil! Yovil!
Just before they were about to put him out of his misery, Yang Yovil appeared.
What's all this? He snapped. I gave orders that Miss Wedensbury was to have absolute quiet. Yovil!
Bunny shouted. Who's that?
Sheffield's assistant.
What, Bunny?
Foyle!
Bunny howled.
Golly, Foyle!
Yang Yovil covered the 50 feet between them in exactly 1.66 seconds. What about Foyle?
Sheffield's got him,
Bunny gasped.
Sheffield? When?
30 minutes ago.
Why didn't he bring him here?
Don't know.
Got an idea. Maybe an OS agent.
Why didn't you come at once?
Sheffield jaunted with Foyle, knocked him stiffer in a mackerel and disappeared. I went looking, all over, took a chance. Must have made 50 jaunts in 20 minutes.
Amateur. Yang Yovel exclaimed in exasperation. "Why didn't you leave that to the pros?"
"Found them."
"You found them? Where?"
"Olds and Pats. Sheffield's after the..."
But Yang Yovel had turned on his heel and was tearing back up the corridor, shouting,
"Robin! Robin! Stop! Stop!"
And then their ears were bruised by the bellow of thunder. Chapter 15. Like widening rings in a pond, the will and the idea spread, searching out, touching and tripping the delicate subatomic trigger of pyre. The thought found particles, dust, smoke, vapour, motes, molecules. The will and the idea transformed them all. In Sicily, where Dottore Franco Torre had worked for an exhausting month attempting to unlock the secret of one slug of pyre, the residues and the precipitates had been dumped down a drain which led to the sea. For many months, the Mediterranean currents had drifted these residues across the sea bottom. In an instant, a humpbacked mound of water, towering 50 feet high, traced the courses northeast to Sardinia and southwest to Tripoli. In a microsecond, the surface of the Mediterranean was raised into the twisted casting of a giant earthworm that wound around the islands of Pantelleria, Lampedusa, Linosa, and Malta. Some of the residues had been burned off, had gone up the chimney with smoke and vapour to drift for hundreds of miles before settling. These minute particles showed where they had finally settled in Morocco, Algeria, Libya, and Greece, with blinding pinpoint explosions of incredible minuteness and intensity. And some motes, still drifting in the stratosphere, revealed their presence with brilliant gleams like daylight stars. In Texas, where Professor John Mantley had had the same baffling experience with pyre, most of the residues had gone down the shaft of an exhausted oil well, which was also used to accommodate radioactive wastes. A deep water table had absorbed much of the matter and spread it slowly over an area of some 10 square miles. 10 square miles of Texas flats shook themselves into corduroy. A vast, untapped deposit of natural gas at last found a vent and came shrieking up to the surface, where sparks from flying stones ignited it into a roaring torch 200 feet high. A milligram of pyre, deposited on a disc of filter paper long since discarded, forgotten, rounded up in a waste paper drive and at last pulped into a mould for type metal, destroyed the entire late-night edition of the Glasgow Observer. A fragment of pyre spattered on a lab smock long since converted into rag paper destroyed a thank-you note written by Lady Shrapnel and destroyed an additional ton of first-class mail in the process. A shirt cuff inadvertently dipped into an acid solution of pyre, long abandoned, along with the shirt, and now worn under his mink suit by a jack-jaunter, blasted off the wrist and hand of the jack-jaunter in one fiery amputation. A decimilligram of pyre, still adhering to a former evaporation crystal, now in use as an ashtray, kindled a fire that scorched the office of one baker, dealer in freaks and purveyor of monsters. Across the length and breadth of the planet were isolated explosions, chains of explosions, traceries of fire, pinpoints of fire, meteor flares in the sky, great craters and narrow channels ploughed in the earth, exploded in the earth, vomited forth from the earth. In Old St. Pat's, nearly a tenth of a gram of pyre was exposed in Fourmile's laboratory. The rest was sealed in its inert lead isotope safe, protected from accidental and intentional psychokinetic ignition. The blinding blast of energy generated from that tenth of a gram blew out the walls and split the floors, as though an internal earthquake had convulsed the building. The buttresses held the pillars for a split second, and then crumbled. Down came towers, spires, pillars, buttresses, and roof, in a thundering avalanche to hesitate above the yawning crater of the floor in a tangled, precarious equilibrium. A breath of wind, a distant vibration, and the collapse would continue until the crater was filled solid with pulverized rubble. The star-like heat of the explosion ignited 100 fires, and melted the ancient thick copper of the collapsed roof. If a milligram more of pyre had been exposed to detonation, the heat would have been intense enough to vaporize the metal immediately. Instead, it glowed white and began to flow. It streamed off the wreckage of the crumbled roof and began searching its way downward through the jumbled stone, iron, wood and glass, like some monstrous molten mould creeping through a tangled web. Dagenham and Yang Yeovil arrived almost simultaneously. A moment later, Robin Wedensbury appeared, and then Gisbella McQueen. A dozen intelligence operatives and 6 Dagenham couriers arrived, along with Prestane's jaunt watch and the police. They formed a cordon around the blazing block, but there were very few spectators. After the shock of the New Year's Eve raid, that single explosion had frightened half New York into another wild jaunt for safety. The uproar of the fire was frightful, and the massive grind of tons of wreckage in uneasy balance was ominous. Everyone was forced to shout, and yet was fearful of the vibrations. Yang Yeovil bawled the news about Foyle and Sheffield into Dagenham's ear. Dagenham nodded and displayed his deadly smile.
"We'll have to go in," he shouted.
"Fire suits," Yang Yeovil shouted. He disappeared and reappeared with a pair of white disaster crew fire suits. At the sight of these, Robin and Gisbella began shouting hysterical objections. The two men ignored them, wriggled into the inert isomer armor, and inched into the inferno. Within Old St. Pat's, it was as though a monstrous hand had churned a logjam of wood, stone, and metal. Through every interstice crawled tongues of molten copper, slowly working downward, igniting wood, crumbling stone, shattering glass. Where the copper flowed, it merely glowed, but where it poured, it spattered dazzling droplets of white-hot metal. Beneath the logjam yawned a black crater, where formerly the floor of the cathedral had been. The explosion had split the flagstone asunder, revealing the cellars, sub-cellars and vaults deep below the building. These, too, were filled with a snarl of stones, beams, pipes, wire, the remnants of the 4-mile circus tents, all fitfully lit small fires. Then the first of the copper dripped down into the crater and illuminated it with a brilliant molten splash. Dagenham pounded Yang Yeovil's shoulder to attract his attention and pointed. Halfway down the crater, in the midst of the tangle, lay the body of Regis Sheffield, drawn and quartered by the explosion. Yang Yeovil pounded Dagenham's shoulder and pointed. Almost at the bottom of the crater lay Gully Foyle, and as the blazing spatter of molten copper illuminated him, they saw him move. The two men at once turned and crawled out of the cathedral for a conference.
"He's alive."
"How's it possible?"
"I can guess. Did you see the shreds of tent wadded near him? It must have been a freak explosion up at the other end of the cathedral, and the tents in between cushioned Foyle. Then he dropped through the floor before anything else could hit him."
"I'll buy that. We've got to get him out. He's the only man who knows where the pyre is."
"Could it still be here, unexploded?"
"If it's in the ILI safe, yes. That stuff is inert to anything. Never mind that now. How are we going to get him out?"
"Well, we can't work down from above."
"Why not?"
"Isn't it obvious? One false step and our whole mess will collapse."
"Did you see that copper flowing down?"
"God, yes."
"Well, if we don't get him out in 10 minutes, he'll be at the bottom of a pool of molten copper."
"What can we do?"
"I've got a long shot."
"What?"
"The cellars of the old RCA buildings across the street are as deep as St. Pat's."
"And?"
"We'll go down and try to hold through. Maybe we can pull Foyle out from the bottom." A squad broke into the ancient RCA buildings, abandoned and sealed up for 2 generations. They went down into the cellar arcades, crumbling museums of the retail stores of centuries past. They located the ancient elevator shafts and dropped through them into the sub-cellars filled with electrical installations, heat plants and refrigeration systems. They went down into the sump cellars, waist-deep in water from the streams of prehistoric Manhattan Island, streams that still flowed beneath the streets that covered them. As they waded through the sump cellars, bearing east-northeast to bring up opposite the St. Pat's vaults, they suddenly discovered that the pitch dark was illuminated by a fiery flickering up ahead. Dagenham shouted and flung himself forward. The explosion that had opened the sub-cellars of St. Pat's had split the septum between its vaults and those of the RCA buildings. Through a jagged rent in stone and earth, they could peer into the bottom of the inferno. 50 feet inside was Foyle, trapped in a labyrinth of twisted beams, stones, pipe, metal, and wire. It was illuminated by a roaring glow from above him, and fitful flames around him. His clothes were on fire, and the tattooing was livid on his face. He moved feebly, like a bewildered man in a maze.
"My God!" Young Yeovil exclaimed. "The Burning Man!"
"What?"
"The Burning Man I saw on the Spanish stairs. Never mind that now. What can we do?"
"Go in, of course."
A brilliant white gob of copper suddenly oozed down close to Foyle and splashed 10 feet below him. It was followed by a second, a third, a slow, steady stream. A pool began to form. Dagenham and Yang Yeovil sealed the faceplates of their armour and crawled through the break in the septum. After 3 minutes of agonised struggling, they realised that they could not get through the labyrinth to Foyle. It was locked to the outside, but not from the inside. Dagenham and Yang Yeovil backed up to confer.
"We can't get to him," Dagenham shouted, "but he can get out."
"How? He can't jaunt, obviously, or he wouldn't be there."
"No, he can climb, look. He goes left, then up, reverses, makes a turn along the beam, slides under it, and pushes through that tangle of wire. The wire can't be pushed in, which is why we can't get to him, but it can push out, which is how he can get out. It's a one-way door."
The pool of molten copper crept up toward Foyle.
"If he doesn't get out soon, he'll be roasted alive."
"We'll have to talk him out. Tell him what to do."
The men began shouting.
"Foyle!
Foyle!
Foyle!"
The burning man in the maze continued to move feebly. The downpour of sizzling copper increased.
"Foyle, turn left. Can you hear me, Foyle? Turn left and climb up. You can get out if you'll listen to me. Turn left and climb up. Then...
Foyle!" "He's not listening. Foyle! Gale Foyle! Can you hear us?"
"Send for Jiz. Maybe he'll listen to her."
"No, Robin. She'll tell us, and he'll have to listen."
"But will she do it? Save him of all people?"
"She'll have to. This is bigger than hatred. It's the biggest damn thing the world's ever encountered. I'll get her."
Yang Yeovil started to crawl out. Dagenham stopped him.
"Wait, Yo. Look at him. He's flickering."
"Flickering?
Look. He's blinking like a glowworm. Watch. Now you see him and now you don't."
The figure of Foyle was appearing, disappearing, and reappearing in rapid succession, like a firefly caught in a flaming trap.
"What's he doing now? What's he trying to do? What's happening?"
He was trying to escape. Like a trapped firefly or some seabird caught in the blazing brazier of a naked beacon fire, he was beating about in a frenzy, a blackened, burning creature dashing himself against the unknown. Sound came as sight to him, as light in strange patterns. He saw the sound of his shouted name in vivid rhythms.
"Foyle, Foyle, 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 Foyle."
Motion came as sound to him. He heard the writhing of the flames, he heard the swirls of smoke. He heard the flickering, jeering shadows, all speaking deafeningly in strange tongues.
"Purugayar warwarjerbeking,"
the steam asked.
"Asha, asha, ritkitit zit megid,"
the quick shadows answered.
"Uwa, heeti uwa,"
the heat ripples clamoured.
"Ama pa la."
Even the flames smouldering on his own clothes roared gibberish in his ears.
"Mantergeistmann!" they bellowed. "Unver Trakenstein genself for Stinglestenbrug!"
Colour was pain to him, heat, cold, pressure. Sensations of intolerable heights and plunging depths, of tremendous accelerations and crushing compressions. Red receded from him.
Green light attacked. Indigo undulated with sickening speed like a shinning snake.
Touch was taste to him. The feel of wood was acrid and chalky in his mouth. Metal was salt. Stone tasted sour sweet to the touch of his fingers. And the feel of glass cloyed his palate like over-rich pastry. Smell was touch. Hot stone smelled like velvet caressing the cheek. Smoke and ash were harsh tweeds rasping his skin, almost the feel of wet canvas. Molten metal smelled like blows hammering his heart, and the ionization of the pyre explosion filled the air with ozone that smelled like water trickling through his fingers. He was not blind, not deaf, not senseless. Sensation came to him, but filtered through a nervous system twisted and short-circuited by the shock of the pyre concussion. He was suffering from synesthesia, that rare condition in which perception receives messages from the objective world and relays these messages to the brain. But there in the brain, the sensory perceptions are confused with one another. So in Foyle, sound registered as sight, motion registered as sound. Colours became pain sensations, touch became taste, and smell became touch. He was not only trapped within the labyrinth of the inferno under Old St. Pat's, he was trapped in the kaleidoscope of his own cross-senses. Again desperate, on the ghastly verge of extinction, he abandoned all disciplines and habits of living. Or perhaps they were stripped from him. He reverted from a conditioned product of environment and experience to an inchoate creature, craving escape and survival, and exercising every power it possessed. And again the miracle of 2 years ago took place. The undivided energy of an entire human organism, of every cell, fibre, nerve and muscle, empowered that craving. And again Foyle space jaunted. He went hurtling along the geodesical space lines of the curving universe at the speed of thought, far exceeding that of light. His spatial velocity was so frightful that his time axis was twisted from the vertical line drawn from the past through now to the future. He went flickering along the new near-horizontal axis, this new space-time geodesic, driven by the miracle of a human mind no longer inhabited by concepts of the impossible. Again he achieved what Helmut Grant and Enzio Dandridge and scores of other experimenters had failed to do, because his blind panic forced him to abandon the spatio-temporal inhibitions that had defeated previous attempts. He did not jaunt to elsewhere, but to elsewhen. But most important, the fourth-dimensional awareness, the complete picture of the arrow of time and his position on it, which is born in every man but deeply submerged by the trivia of living, was in Foyle close to the surface. He jaunted along the space-time geodesics to elsewheres and elsewhens, translating I, the square root of -1, from an imaginary number into reality by a magnificent act of imagination. He jaunted. He was a bored nomad, drifting in the empty frost of space. He stood in the door to nowhere. The cold was the taste of lemons, and the vacuum was a rake of talons on his skin. The sun and the stars were a shaking ague that racked his bones.
"Glommer Frednis de Glommer Hammergensin,"
motion roared in his ears. It was a figure with his back to him, vanishing down the corridor, a figure with a copper cauldron of provisions over its shoulder, a figure darting, floating, squirming through free fall. It was Gully Foyle.
"Me hat jes rot to Cronagan, but Flimcork—"
The sight of his motion bellowed.
"Aha! Ho ho! Me git not to cack!"
The flicker of light and shade answered.
"Oh, so, no, ah!"
the whirling raffle of debris in his wake murmured. The lemon taste in his mouth became unbearable. The rake of talons on his skin was torture. He jaunted. He reappeared in the furnace beneath Old St. Pat's less than a second after he had disappeared from there. He was drawn, as the seabird is drawn again and again, to the flame from which it is struggling to escape. He endured the roaring torture for only another moment. He jaunted. He was in the depths of Gouffre Martel. The velvet black darkness was bliss, paradise, euphoria. "Ah!" he cried in relief. "Ah!" came the echo of his voice, and the sound was translated into a blinding pattern of light. The burning man winced. "Stop!" he called, blinded by the noise. Again came the dazzling pattern of the echo. "Stop, stop, 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 stop." A distant clatter of steps came to his eyes in soft patterns of vertical borealis streamers. Clatter, 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 clatter. Clatter. There came a shout like a zigzag of lightning. A beam of light attacked. It was the search party from the Gouffre Martel Hospital, tracking Foyle and Gisbella McQueen by geophone. The burning man disappeared, but not before he had unwittingly decoyed the searchers from the trail of the vanished fugitives. He was back under Old St. Pat's, reappearing only an instant after his last disappearance. His wild beatings into the unknown sent him stumbling up geodesic space-time lines that inevitably brought him back to the now he was trying to escape, for in the inverted saddle curve of space-time, his now was the deepest depression in the curve. He could drive himself up, up, up the geodesic lines into the past or future, but inevitably he must fall back into his own now, like a thrown ball hurled up the sloping walls of an infinite pit, to land, hang poised for a moment, and then roll back into the depths. But still he beat into the unknown in his desperation. Again he jaunted. He was on Jervis Beach on the Australian coast. The motion of the surf was bawling, "Logamist, Krota Haven Jal, Lugamisk Motislaven Dool." And the churning of the surf blinded him with the lights of batteries of footlights. Gully Foyle and Robin Wedensbury stood before him. The body of a man lay on the sand, which felt like vinegar in the burning man's mouth. The wind brushing his face tasted like brown paper. Foyle opened his mouth and exclaimed. The sound came out in burning star bubbles. Foyle took a step. "Grash!" the motion blared. The burning man jaunted. He was in the office of Dr. Sergei Orel in Shanghai. Foyle was again before him, speaking in light patterns. "Who are you? Who are you? Who are you?" He flickered back to the agony of Old St. Pat's and jaunted again. He was on the brawling Spanish stairs. 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 The burning man jaunted. It was cold again, with the taste of lemons, and the vacuum raked his skin with unspeakable talons. He was peering through the porthole of a silvery yawl. The jagged mountains of the moon towered in the background. Through the porthole he could see the jangling racket of blood pumps and oxygen pumps, and hear the uproar of the motion Gully Foyle made toward him. The clawing of the vacuum caught his throat in an agonizing grip. The geodesic lines of space-time rolled him back to now under Old St. Pat's, where less than 2 seconds had elapsed since he first began his frenzied struggle. Once more, like a burning spear, he hurled himself into the unknown. He was in the Skopski catacomb on Mars. The white slug that was Lindsay Joyce was writhing before him.
"No, no, no!" her motion screamed. "Don't hurt me, don't kill me. No, please, please, please."
The burning man opened his tiger mouth and laughed.
"She hurts," he said. The sound of his voice burnt his eyes. "She hurts, she hurts, she hurts, she hurts, she hurts, she hurts, she hurts."
"Who are you?"
Foyle whispered.
"Who? Ar, 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 ar.
The burning man winced.
"Too bright," he said. "Less light."
Foyle took a step forward.
"Blagada mofra mishinglistan vista,"
the motion roared. The burning man clapped his hands over his ears in agony.
"Too loud," he cried. "Don't move so loud."
The writhing Skopsi's motion was still screaming, beseeching.
"Don't hurt me, don't hurt me."
The burning man laughed again.
"Listen to her, she's screaming, begging. She doesn't want to die. She doesn't want to be hurt. Listen to her."
"It was Olivia Prestain gave the order. Olivia Prestain, not me, don't hurt me. Olivia Prestain."
"She's telling who gave the order, can't you hear? Listen with your eyes. She says Olivia."
What?
The checkerboard glitter of Foyle's question was too much for him.
"She says Olivia, Olivia Prestain, Olivia Prestain, Olivia Prestain,"
he jaunted. He fell back into the pit under Old St. Pat's, and suddenly his confusion and despair told him he was dead. This was the finish of Gully Foyle. This was eternity, and hell was real. What he had seen was the past, passing before his crumbling senses in the final moment of death. What he was enduring, he must endure through all time. He was dead. He knew he was dead. He refused to submit to eternity. He beat again into the unknown. The burning man jaunted. He was in a scintillating mist, a snowflake cluster of stars, a shower of liquid diamonds. There was the taste of a strand of cool pearls in his mouth. His crossed kaleidoscopic senses could not tell him where he was, but he knew he wanted to remain in this nowhere forever.
"Hello, Gully."
"Who's that?"
"This is Robin."
"Robin?"
"Robin Wednesbury, that was."
"That was?"
"Robin Yorville, that is."
"I don't understand. Am I dead?"
"No, Gully."
"Where am I?"
"A long, long way from Old St. Pat's."
"But where?"
"I can't take the time to explain, Gully. You've only got a few moments here."
"Why?"
"Because you haven't learned how to jaunt through space-time yet. You've got to go back and learn."
"But I do know. I must know.
Sheffield said I space-jaunted a nomad 600,000 miles. "That was an accident then, Gully, and you'll do it again, after you teach yourself. But you're not doing it now. You don't know how to hold on yet, how to turn any now into reality. You'll tumble back into Old St. Pat's in a moment."
"Robin, I've just remembered. I have bad news for you."
"I know, Gully."
"Your mother and sisters are dead."
"I've known for a long time, Gully."
"How long?"
"For 30 years.
"That's impossible."
"No, it isn't. This is a long, long way from Old St. Pat's. I've been waiting to tell you how to save yourself from the fire, Gully. Will you listen?"
"I'm not dead?"
"No."
"I'll listen."
Your senses are all confused. It'll pass soon, but I won't give the directions in left or right or up and down. I'll tell you what you can understand now.
Why are you helping me? After what I've done to you,